As Mike said, today's service is from the Church of the Larger Fellowship. It's an online resource that we can use when we are unable to have a speaker. And this particular service was written by Reverend Tony Larson, and he's the minister at Olympia Brown Church in Racine. And it's called, "If You're Only Looking for Happiness." So these are his words. "The U.S. Constitution guarantees us the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's an accepted truism that happiness is one of life's goals. Even our fairy tales end with, 'and they lived happily ever after.' No, they didn't. They didn't live happily ever after. You know those stories you heard as a kid? No one who gets married lives happily ever after." One elderly woman on her wedding anniversary said, "I've been happily married for 25 years. Someone said, "But you've been married for 50. She said, "Right. I've been happily married for 25 of those 50 years. Half is about right. You don't get to be happy all of the time. You shouldn't even try. In fact, pursuing happiness is one of the surest ways to miss it. As the American writer and Pulitzer Prize winner Edith Wharton put it, if we'd only stop trying to be happy, we'd have a pretty good time." I'm not saying that happiness is a bad thing. All other things being equal, I'd rather be happy than sad. But it's not the only goal in life, and it's not even the major one. A major goal in life, as I see it, is to contribute, to love, to help, to heal. Happiness is a frequent byproduct of contribution, but it doesn't always come. And even if it did, you don't get to skip to the byproduct without going through the contributing. Unfortunately, by making happiness a major goal in life and making it seem like something you can achieve, our society ends up decreasing the possibility of achieving it. You see, I think one of the causes of unhappiness in our society today is the pursuit of happiness. I think that's one of the reasons we have a drug problem. We tell people to pursue happiness. We tell them not to do drugs, but they know that drugs make them happy. It's a conflicting message. And we are bombarded with TV ads showing us how to eat better, drink better, feel better, look better, smell better, with the implicit promise that these things will make us happy. And there's never an end to how many things you think you'll need to be happy. If you keep pursuing happiness, there will never be an end in sight. There's a fairy tale from Japan about a stonecutter who met an old woman in the forest who was hungry and thirsty. So he gave her some food and water, and suddenly she became a beautiful, radiant being, the goddess of the forest. And she said, "Because of your good deeds, I will grant you 5 wishes," and then she disappeared. A little while later, the stonecutter happened to be back in the village when he saw the prince go by with his brave warriors and shining armor. And he thought, "How powerful this prince is. I wish I could be a prince." And suddenly he was, with a palace and gold and beautiful gardens. But a great wind came up and tore the leaves from the trees and forced him and all his subjects to hide from it. So he said to himself, "The wind is mightier than the prince, and that is what I wish to be." And he became the wind, blowing the waves of the sea and bending the trees on the mountains. But then the sun came out, heating and scorching the earth and reducing him to nothing more than a light breeze. So he wished to be the sun. And he dried up wells and lakes and made flowers grow or withered them, and he felt very powerful till a storm cloud came and blocked out all his rays so that he wished to be the storm cloud. And so he did. And he reigned all over the world, flooded great cities, feeling very powerful until he saw a huge stone in the forest that he could not move no matter how many torrents of rain he sent down. So he wished for his last wish to be the giant stone. And so he was, resting firmly on the forest floor, moved by neither storm nor sun nor wind, feeling happy and powerful, till he heard the sound of a stone cutter. There's no end to it. Oscar Wilde once said, "In this world, there are only two tragedies. One is not getting what one wants. The other is getting it." As long as you keep wishing for something that will make you happy, you're setting yourself up for disappointment. The truth of the matter is that happiness is sort of like a cat. As Robertson Davies once put it, if you try to coax happiness, it will avoid you. But if you pay no attention to it, it will rub up against your legs and spring unbidden into your lap. When it comes at all, happiness arrives as a byproduct of contributing to something else, even though contributing won't guarantee it. I like to make a distinction between joy and happiness. Contributing always brings you joy, but it doesn't always bring you happiness. You see, joy is not always smiling or laughing. It is sometimes a thing of tears. So I use these words, happiness means caring about people who are interesting and fun to be with. Joy means caring not just for fun people, but for people who aren't exciting, people who are passed over by others. Happiness means celebrating a birthday with a friend. Joy means sharing in a celebration, but also being there to share a friend's grief or a friend's hurt. Happiness is contributing your time or money to a foundation or a home where you get good PR out of it. People think you're generous as a result of that. Joy is doing that, but joy is also giving when no one knows about it. No one ever thanks you. Happiness is taking a stand on a political or moral issue and having friends to support your position and praise you for your courage. Joy is doing that, but it's also taking a stand when your friends abandon you and you feel alone, and yet you take your stand anyway because you know it's the right thing to do. In other words, while joy includes the feelings of bliss or happiness, it's more than that. Joy is sometimes unhappy, sometimes lonely. Joy sometimes includes suffering, sometimes includes boredom. This is why I like to end each worship service with peace and unrest. The word unrest is there to remind you of the darker side of joy. Let me tell you how that got started. When I was a student minister at the Unitarian Church in Rockford, Illinois, this was in 1974, the senior minister there used to end every service by saying, "Peace." He'd say the closing words and then he would just say, "Peace." It was pretty nice. But sometimes I thought there was too much peace in that congregation. A lot of peace and a lot of comfort. You see, the members of that UU church lived pretty well. Most of them were upper class or at least upper middle class. And that was pretty hard for me to get used to. I grew up in a fairly poor family. There were six kids. My dad didn't make much money. We never went hungry or anything, but there were certain things that made us feel different from other people. Few minor examples, such as in our family, we didn't learn how to set the table the way other people did because we didn't have matching plates or silverware, didn't have matching anything. We were afraid of the police. They're not on your side necessarily if you're poor. At least that's how you feel. We didn't learn how to make a bed properly. Minor things, but we never had sheets on our beds, so we didn't know what to do with them when I discovered other people used them. We didn't take a bath every day. Took one once a week. So when I came to the Rockford Unitarian Church and met all these rich people and even just middle class people, I wasn't sure how to act. And I guess I grew up with a typical lower class view of wealthy people. I felt unworthy of them, but somehow I felt superior to them at the same time. That's what always happens when you grow up feeling disadvantaged. You end up feeling superior and inferior. We all grew up with our prejudices, and anti-rich was one of mine. So here I was at this Unitarian church, learning to be a minister to people that I felt both a little afraid of and morally superior to. So I gave them a sermon to all these comfortable people. It was called, "Why the Church Should Make You Uncomfortable." In it, I said, "I've heard a lot of people here say, I come to this church because it's the only one I feel comfortable in." Or, I like this church because the minister here never makes me feel guilty. But, I said, the church should offer you more than peace. The minister's job is not just to comfort the afflicted, but also to afflict the comfortable. And if you make a good income, I know a lot of you do, then you should be giving big chunks of it away to help feed the 40,000 people who are dying every day of hunger, people you could help prevent from dying by seeing beyond your comfortable corner of the world. Well, not everybody liked that sermon, but a surprising number actually did. Some people even came up to me afterwards and said, "This church really needed to hear that." Of course, I don't know whether anyone did anything as a result of the sermon. For all I know, the people who liked it may have just liked being scolded. But since the minister there always ended his services by saying, "Peace," I ended that service by saying, "Discomfort." And that's how it got started, my custom of ending the service that way. When I gave that sermon in Rockford, I was right that church should make you feel uncomfortable sometimes. But I was wrong in thinking people who are wealthy are the only ones who should be shaken out of their comfort. And I was wrong in assuming that people who are wealthy are necessarily assured a comfortable life. I know now people who grew up with money and who were abused by their parents or were the victims of alcohol abuse. Everyone has some unrest in his or her life. Not to the same degree as everyone else, but we all have a frightened little child inside who's just hoping no one will notice what's wrong with us. And every one of us needs to be shaken out of some comfortable place in our lives. As for myself, I'm now in that middle class that I used to be so judgmental towards. It's true, I wasn't born into it, so I'm still learning how to act, but I'm told I pass pretty well. So what I told that Rockford congregation, I need to also tell myself. My life is getting comfortable in the same way theirs was. I now have money to spend, and there are people who need what my money could help to give them, poor black families who are trying to send their kids to college, whom I can help by contributing to the United Negro College Fund, homeless people who need counseling and support and shelter that my contribution can help keep alive, peace groups and environmental organizations that need my money to help try and save the planet. A lot of problems out there, and I should feel uncomfortable about them. And I should never be satisfied that I've done enough, not when I'm spending a lot of time and money on myself. I remember years ago when the Catholic Church added the so-called kiss of peace to the Mass. That's the part where you turn to your neighbor and shake hands, much as we do here, and say, "May the peace of Christ be with you." And at one Mass that I attended, someone turned to me and said, "May the unrest of Christ be with you." And it struck me then that most of what Jesus talked about when he was alive was not very comforting. It was more restless than peaceful. May the unrest of Christ be with you. I've since come to see that it would be just as appropriate to say, "May the unrest of the Buddha be with you," or "the unrest of Susan B. Anthony," or "the unrest of the Jewish prophets." I believe it doesn't matter so much who your saviors or models for living are. What does matter is that you share some of their unrest. You never get to be in a state of total peace, not unless you go to a very special doctor, the kind that does lobotomies. Then maybe you can get to a state of complete nirvana. But if your mind is fully engaged and you have an ounce of compassion, then you should suffer unrest all your life. When we see natural and human-made horrors and disasters which occur in this community and around the world, how can we not hurt for those people? So no matter how hard we try to be at peace inside, we'll never be free of unrest. The image I like for what a religious group is supposed to be is from the Jewish scriptures, where the book of Deuteronomy describes God's way of dealing with God's children. It says that God is like an eagle that stirs up its nest, that flutters over its young. I like that. That's what this religious group is supposed to do. Stir you up, flutter over you, get you to fly, push you out of the nest. And I don't mean the kind of unrest you feel when you hear a sermon on some social issue or when the speaker takes a position you agree with, so you say, yeah, that's right. That's okay, but I'm talking about the kind of unrest that hits you personally, that challenges you, that doesn't just confirm your beliefs about what's wrong with the world, but actually confronts you and with the demand to do something about it. You know, many people believe that the deepest spiritual feeling you can have is the feeling of peace and happiness that you get when you feel oneness with everything. But some of my own deepest religious feelings have not been happy or peaceful. They have had to do with oneness, but they were unsettling because through them I saw how far away I was from that oneness. When I went to India and China several years ago, for example, I went to visit Krishna's birthplace and see the place of Buddha's enlightenment and wash in the sacred river Ganges, sit in the temple of Confucius. And I thought I might have some special religious experience at those places. And I did to some extent. But my most powerful experiences happened before my tour began, when I was in Bombay. I stayed at the Bombay Methodist Center and then at the nearby YMCA. There was a Seventh-day Adventist church close by as well, and a Muslim mosque and Hindu shrine and temples. It was sort of a ecumenical arena. But the religious feelings I had there had more to do with the people I saw living in the streets than the religious buildings in that neighborhood. So it's 6 a.m., I'm jogging around the neighborhood, not too far so I don't get lost. There's the smell of smoke in the air. A few early risers are making breakfast fires on the sides of the road. The smell of smoke mingles with the odors of the many animals wandering around everywhere, with the dirt and dust, for these streets are not paved. Mingles, too, with the ever-present smell of feces, both animal and human, for there's no sanitation for the poor, and you must be careful where you walk. Taxi drivers are asleep in their cars, having spent the night in front of the Y, so they can be the first to get some foreign passengers. Others are asleep in their homes, if you can call them homes. They're really just pieces of plastic and cardboard and canvas, makeshift tents leaned up against the walls. Some people don't even have this. They live out in the open. See little children sleeping alongside their parents in the dirt. Think of how dangerous it must be to sleep unprotected out in the streets. But then I realize they have no fear of muggers. They have nothing anyone else wants. I run past an old man with a terrible hacking cough. Each time I pass him, I hear the same awful sound with no pause, no relief, just continual coughing. And I wonder if he will be alive tomorrow. A man carrying a load on his head is urinating against a wall as the voice of a mullah comes out over a loudspeaker system calling on all Muslims to praise God. But I wonder whom these people in the street pray to. Can they honestly praise God? Any God? Back at the Y, when my running is over, I read the posters on the walls. Jesus is number one, reads one of them. He is ruler of all. And I think to myself, is he number one for the poor? Has he ever helped them? He is the ruler of all. Does he rule over the stench and the filth? Another poster quotes Colossians 2. He has authority over every other power. And I think to myself, does he have authority over the power of disease and despair? Somehow these optimistic sayings seem ironic or even cruel, hanging as they do inside a neat, clean building that's surrounded by poverty. Slogans like these are fine for well-fed foreigners who have a very comfortable God to protect them from the darkness outside. But the people who live in that darkness, where is their God? They're hungry, and they cannot eat inspirational words or comforting Bible passages. My mind goes back to other words I've heard, the words of Gandhi. There are so many hungry people in the world, he said, that God cannot appear to them except in the form of bread. And I hear Jesus' word again. I was hungry, and you gave me to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me to drink. What a dirty place this is to look for God. But there they are, the hungry, the thirsty, the naked, the sick, the least of my brothers and sisters, the dwelling place of the Most High. And that is a religious experience for me. It's not the kind I'd like to have often, I like the peaceful, happy kind much better. But it is the restless kind of joy that has ended up changing me. And I need that from time to time. I think you do too.